This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Australia considers protection for Hong Kong residents who may want to flee after Beijing slaps draconian security laws on the territory. A growing sense of crisis in Victoria as the chief health officer admits he's worried about the number of coronavirus cases where they haven't yet found a source. And 500 big-name US companies, including Coca-Cola, are saying no to hate speech by pulling advertising from Facebook, and the movement is in Australia too.
Today, we've got an email from a client who wants us to pause advertising for one day on July the 7th on Facebook.
Just the fact of a boycott, and a boycott with many major folks, helps other people to be aware of how Facebook is failing to deal with hate speech.
Well, China's foreign ministry is not happy with Australia's reaction to what it's doing in Hong Kong, tonight telling Australia to stop interfering in its internal affairs. Australia is considering offering safe haven visas to anyone from Hong Kong deemed in need of protection because of Beijing's sweeping new national security law. But China says no power will shake its resolve to protect Hong Kong's stability and prosperity. The UK is going to allow up to 3 million Hong Kongers the chance to settle there. A look at the laws themselves in a moment, but first Barbara Miller has this report.
Australia has form when it comes to offering protection to those it deems at risk of Chinese aggression. This was Prime Minister Bob Hawke's emotional response to the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989.
Foot soldiers went through the square bayoneting or shooting anybody who was still alive.
Bob Hawke offered thousands of students in Australia at the time the chance to stay. This time it's events in Hong Kong troubling the government. A draconian new national security law has prompted the current Prime Minister to say he's considering offering safe haven to Hong Kongers.
We are considering very actively in their proposals that I asked to be brought forward several weeks ago. And the final touches are being put on those, and they'll soon be considered by Cabinet to provide similar opportunities. And we think that's important and very consistent with who we are as a people.
Details have not been made public, but Mary Crock, Professor of Public Law at Sydney Law School, says any protection would likely be time-limited.
The safe haven visa that is being touted today is particularly interesting because it's a visa that you cannot apply for. It's what I call a tap on the shoulder visa, where the government decides we're going to give this cohort the right to remain in Australia for a certain period. And that's it, point in time safety mechanisms, and do not allow for even extensions. There are a lot of people already physically in Australia who would be able to take advantage of this.
And you would read it as something more for people who are here, just as the Chinese students after Tiananmen Square were already here, rather than people who would come from Hong Kong seeking safe haven.
That's correct. But having said that, I mean, nobody's travelling anywhere at the moment. That's part of the problem. But it doesn't mean that once people have made it to Australia by whatever means, that they would be able to access something like that.
Bin Ling is a professor of Chinese law at the University of Sydney and former Hong Kong resident and scholar.
Well, I think it would be helpful as a humanitarian measure. In the past few days, we have seen some of the leading Hong Kong activists who apparently have been frightened by this law and who have quit their organizations, stopped their political activities and tried to find places to go to. So I think the Australian measure obviously would show international solidarity with Hong Kong people, and it would be helpful to provide some support for the people in Hong Kong. And I think overall it would be good.
Lily, not her real name, was born and raised in Hong Kong. She's welcomed the news from Australia and from the UK government, who will offer those born in Hong Kong before the handover the chance of residency.
Of course, I'm delighted by the news. It's kind of like a silver lining, like in such a time of turbulence. It's just like the end of Hong Kong. It truly is a turning point. But my worry would be like, what about those who were born after 1997? Because they are the ones who don't have the BNO, like the British National Overseas passport. So that means that it will be very difficult for them to get out of Hong Kong. And these are the people that I really care about. So
what about, for example, the Australian government saying it's looking into safe haven visas? We don't have those details yet, but does that give you some hope for the younger people?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, like, it's remained to be seen, like, because we don't know the details yet. But I definitely hope that they can come for the younger ones.
Lily says she personally would probably stay in Hong Kong, at least for now.
Barbara Miller with that report. Well, China is infuriated by Britain's offer of residency to up to 3 million Hong Kongers. It says Britain has no right to make such an offer, that it's a breach of agreements and that it'll take corresponding measures. So is China considering blocking anyone from Hong Kong who wants to leave? I asked Anthony Dapperan, who is a lawyer in Hong Kong.
Well, that does sound like what they are threatening, and you really have to wonder what they're going to do to try and implement that. Are they going to physically stop people leaving at the border? And if so, are they effectively therefore taking 3 million people hostage? It's quite a remarkable claim to make.
But Hong Kongers do have a right of freedom to movement, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. They have the right to freedom of movement. They have the right to come and go from Hong Kong as they please. They have travel documents that allow them to travel the world. So it would require some very fundamental change in the way Hong Kong is run to implement this ban that China seemed to be contemplating.
Let's take a step back, because I want you to talk us through what kinds of actions this national security law actually has made illegal and indeed punishable by up to life in jail.
Well, there are four categories of new crimes that are created: secession, subversion, terrorism, and colluding with foreign forces. Now, each of these are very broadly defined, but also in the way that they're defined seems specifically to be targeted at some of the behaviour that we saw during the protests over the last year. So, for example, the terrorism offence covers any kind of behaviour that has a political motivation and involves not only violence, but things like attacking, vandalising public transportation equipment, which was something that protesters did last year, the use of arson and bombs, which includes, of course, the petrol bombs and Molotov cocktails, but also extends to anyone providing any sort of aid or assistance to people committing these crimes. So all the moderate people in Hong Kong who supported the protesters in various ways, such as donating goods or funds or helping to drive them to or from protests, or standing in the back line sort of supporting the frontline protesters, would all potentially be caught up as aiding and abetting terrorists under this new law.
So when Hong Kong's chief executive Carrie Lam says the law only targets a small minority of Hong Kongers, is that accurate?
Well, it's frankly very difficult to take that at face value when we saw a number of arrests yesterday of people simply for having in their possession banners that had slogans about Hong Kong independence or stickers bearing slogans of Hong Kong independence. And when the police held up warning banners saying that anyone chanting certain forbidden slogans would be at risk of arrest. Now, that's a very wide net. That's not just targeting a small number of violent protesters, say, which Carrie Lam had seemed to be suggesting the law would.
And so how are Hong Kong's courts and legal system affected? Is there any hope that they will be able to make independent decisions now?
Well, the first major challenge is that there's really no Hong Kong lawyer or Hong Kong judge who can decide definitively how to interpret and apply this law, because it is a piece of mainland Chinese legislation drafted very differently to the kind of laws we have in Hong Kong, which are informed by the British common law tradition as we have in Australia. And also, ultimately, the power of interpretation lies with Beijing. And so Beijing ultimately can dictate to the Hong Kong courts how they want this law interpreted and applied. I think it's going to be very interesting to see the first test cases and see how the Hong Kong courts handle this. But I think it would not be wise to look to rely on them as some sort of guarantor of rights and freedoms under this law.
Now, we saw all those arrests, of course, yesterday. The law will establish a Chinese security apparatus in Hong Kong as well. Are we now going to see a mass enforcement clampdown?
That's what many people fear. And certainly the fact that the mainland Chinese security authorities will be operating here and operating here outside the law, that the new security law says specifically that the Hong Kong laws don't apply to them when they're carrying out their duty, raises fears not only of a mass campaign of enforcement by local Hong Kong authorities, but the mainland authorities stepping in and targeting people that they wish to target. So there's certainly a climate of fear that's very quickly descended on the city.
Anthony Dapperan, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Lawyer Anthony Dapperan speaking from Hong Kong. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, the ABC Listen app, and we are a podcast. I'm Linda Mottram, and on Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, with a surge in land clearing rates across parts of Australia, there are grave fears about a deforestation crisis.
We've just really got a long, long, long way to go. And, you know, the scales are tipped way too far in the human-centred direction at the moment, which is understandable. But I guess until there's a dollar value placed on biodiversity and on the environment, it's not going to happen.
The COVID-19 milestones keep on coming. Today, Australia's infection numbers topped 8,000. In Victoria, there's a growing sense of crisis, with the chief health officer concerned by the growing number of cases that can't yet be traced to a known source. And as that state announces the terms of reference for its hotel quarantine inquiry, both New South Wales and the Northern Territory announce new cases connected to Melbourne's hotels. Samantha Donovan has the latest.
Jodie Gordon lives with her two children in Keilor Lodge, one of the lockdown suburbs in Melbourne's northwest. She's finding the new stay-at-home orders hard, especially when neighbours a short walk away aren't in the hot zone.
It's hard when everybody else is out having fun and we're not. It's school holidays. We're going through this again. The uncertainty of the future. Are we going to have to go through homeschooling again? You know, today the police are down in the village checking driver's licences. It's exactly what they should be doing, but it's not. It doesn't feel cool to be in your own backyard and being checked for whether or not you're allowed to be there.
Of the 86 new coronavirus cases in Australia, 77 are in Victoria. 20 people are in hospital and 4 of them are in intensive care. Victoria's Chief Health Officer, Brett Sutton.
I get some comfort from stabilisation in numbers, but it is never an easy place to sit when you've got 415 active cases, all of which are infectious. Obviously, we've identified them. They're in isolation. Their close contacts are in quarantine. But it's an indication of a very large number of people who've acquired it, which means there are other infections still to be found out there. And they're all at risk of transmitting to others if we're not doing the right thing. And so the restrictions that are in place, even though they apply to those restricted postcodes, we need to bear in mind that it's something for all of us to do, especially across Melbourne, but really the whole of Victoria.
Many of the cases in Melbourne's hot zone are linked to security guards who worked at two of Melbourne's quarantine hotels. And now New South Wales and the Northern Territory have each recorded a case with the same origin. The Victorian government has ordered an inquiry into its hotel quarantine program. It'll be led by Justice Jennifer Coate, who served on the benches of the magistrates, coroners, children's and federal courts, and on the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sex Abuse. The inquiry will examine decisions and actions of government agencies, hotel operators and private contractors. A report is due by September the 25th. Victoria's Police Minister Lisa Neville was asked for her reaction to reports security guards at the hotels, many of whom contracted the virus, had sex with returned travellers.
If people have breached the rules, that the training, the rules, then people need to be held accountable. So if those things have happened, then that's completely inappropriate and people need to be held to account. You know, I'm not in a position to know whether that's accurate or not, but that's where we'll get to hopefully through the inquiry. I'm angry about whether it was individuals, whether it was companies, that people did not take this seriously enough and we've got this spread.
1,000 police officers are on the streets of Melbourne's hot zone today enforcing the stay-at-home orders. And the new Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police, Shane Patton, is warning fines of more than $1,600 will be issued to people who break the rules.
For those who are selfish enough to disregard these warnings from the CHO, the deliberate, obvious and blatant breaches, we will be infringing them. The window of police discretion is a very small window at the moment, I can assure you, and it's rapidly closing. With this threat to public health, that leniency is dissipating day by day. You would have to have been on Mars not to understand that the chief health officer restrictions apply in these 36 suburbs and that you're expected to adhere to them.
Announcing the lockdown on Tuesday, the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, was confident children in the hot zone would be returning to the classroom when school holidays finish. But now the state's chief health officer, Brett Sutton, isn't so sure.
There has been some student-to-student transmission and also teacher-to-teacher transmission at some schools. Again, when there's a heavy load of community transmission, more students getting infected.
And he admits that's something we haven't seen before in Australia.
I also think that we weren't sufficiently pushing for testing of students or of kids, and maybe because we hadn't had a lot of cases in kids, there wasn't a real push. But we're now obviously engaging with a lot of families getting testing of kids at a household level.
And for the Melburnians unhappy at being locked down, Professor Sutton has this reminder.
This entire pandemic that's now infecting 200,000 people a day globally started with one person and has killed more than 500,000 people. This will be a pandemic that has the potential to kill 5 or 10 or more million people worldwide.
Victoria's Chief Health Officer Brett Sutton, Samantha Donovan with that report. Voters in the electorate of Eden Monaro will be the first to choose a new federal MP in the wake of the Black Summer bushfires and the coronavirus pandemic. There's a by-election in the southern New South Wales seat this weekend, triggered by the resignation of Labor MP Mike Kelly for health reasons. Eleni Soltis reports.
When polls open across the Eden Monaro electorate, the prime focus for many locals is the road to recovery in the wake of last summer's devastating bushfires.
Hello, my name is Veronica Abbott and I am the coordinator of Korma Bushfire Relief Centre.
In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and social distancing measures, Veronica Abbott is still helping bushfire-affected residents in Korma, just south of Cobargo.
People who are basically still cobbling together a combination of tents and caravans and maybe a shipping container so that they can still live on the property that is their home.
And it's the winter months.
It's freezing.
Despite the challenges locals are facing, Veronica Abbott says she expects no significant change to come out from the by-election.
If it's anything but a formality, I would pay so much more attention if it was actually a general election. I'd be all over it.
Jenny Robb is a committee member at the Eden Chamber of Commerce. She also runs a kayaking business. She says since the start of January, when tourists were told to evacuate the bushfire-ravaged region, there have been almost no visitors. She's very worried about the looming economic cliff in September when government coronavirus payments are due to expire.
The fact that they're not willing to let the cat out of the bag before a by-election is a little indicative that they're not going to be there for us post-September.
If the last election is anything to go by, it will be extraordinarily tight. The margin in this traditionally bellwether seat is 0.9%, with Liberal candidate Fiona Kotvoyes presenting a strong challenge to the departing member, Labor's Mike Kelly. This time, Fiona Kotvoyes is putting the government's performance during the pandemic at the centre of her campaign.
When I've been out speaking to businesses all across our electorate, what they've said to me is that without JobKeeper, they would have had to close their doors. The key thing is that the Prime Minister has made it very clear that whatever is needed will be done.
Ms. Kotvoyes is up against Christy McBain, the candidate for Labor. She has been a leading voice in the region during the fires as the Mayor of Bega Valley Shire.
Traumatised people should not be spending hours on phone lines talking to different government agencies. We know now more than ever, given how many people the Black Summer bushfires have affected, that there has to be a better response and it has to be led by the federal government.
Local farmer Trevor Hicks is the Nationals candidate. He was selected after the messy stoush between state Liberal MP Andrew Constance and New South Wales Nationals leader John Barilaro, both of whom were vying to contest the by-election at one point. Mr. Barilaro is now denying a report he asked his party's voters to preference Labor ahead of the Liberals. Mr. Hicks on ABC News Radio is also rejecting the suggestion.
No. We've got people out there handing out how to vote cards, and we've certainly put Fiona Kotvoyes second on that card.
There are more than 110,000 registered voters in Eden Monaro, and more than half of them are in Queanbeyan, where Mr. Hicks has been a local councillor for the past 8 years. The bushfires didn't reach these parts. Local solicitor Bill Baker says it's hard to predict how residents in Queanbeyan will vote.
Queanbeyan does have the comfort of the ACT Federal Public Service alongside, and we've got a strong state public service presence in Queanbeyan as well. That's not to say, though, that we're not sympathetic to the plight of our neighbours on the coast and further south. So it's hard to tell, but I think that there'll be some subtle differences.
But it's that subtle difference which will make Eden Monaro a tight race.
Eleni Soltis with that report. We know the summer's terrifying bushfires took a heavy toll on native wildlife. This week there's been a warning koalas could be extinct in New South Wales within 30 years. Today, new data shows tree clearing more than doubled in New South Wales in the decade to 2018. Some in agriculture have downplayed the findings. Conservationists want urgent action, saying there's a potential habitat crisis. Gavin Coote reports.
For wildlife carer Martine Moran, there's often little reprieve from the demands of the volunteer job.
I've been involved with wires for well over 20 years, and I've been looking after koalas for a considerable amount of that time.
She lives in the New South Wales town of Gunnedah, which is dubbed the koala capital of the world, and admits this title has become a bit more tenuous in recent times. This is because of the pressures the local koala population has come under.
It has been awful. Besides the drought and the extremely hot weather, they also were dealing with other threats, like they had chlamydia to deal with. There's been more industries coming up this way and more people living here. So being a koala carer, you're under a bit of stress to make sure you do the right thing by the koalas here too.
The northwest region of New South Wales, where Gunnedah lies, has seen the biggest increases in land clearing according to new data from the state government. It shows rates of vegetation loss across the whole state had more than doubled in the decade up to 2018. The report shows almost 61,000 hectares of woody vegetation had been cleared in 2018. It comes as little surprise to conservationists.
And not with the economic growth that's going on at the moment and the demand for food worldwide, rising populations, all those pressures on governments.
Christine Hosking is a conservation planner with the University of Queensland and blames all levels of government for the surge in land clearing. But she argues the relaxation of native vegetation laws in New South Wales 3 years ago has been a big factor.
The land clearing is yet another level of threat to koalas on top of the fires and climate change. So they all act together to, you know, put the koala into even more peril, basically.
A New South Wales parliamentary report released this week found koalas are at risk of extinction by 2050, laying blame in part on a rise in land clearing. The Office of Environment Data shows in both 2017 and 18, agriculture accounted for about half of the vegetation clearing, with the remainder caused by forestry and infrastructure. Mitchell Clapham farms on the state's central tablelands and sits on the New South Wales Farmers Natural Resources Committee. He urges caution when reading the land clearing figures.
And there's no delineation in this as to what was clearing of regrowth, invasive native scrub, or actually clearing of land. So it's written in a manner to tug at the heartstrings and invoke a sense of panic and urgency, and it's just far from the truth of what the situation really is.
There is no shortage of panic, given some of these predictions that koalas could be extinct within 30 years. Do you think there needs to be a balance shift potentially back towards the environmental end?
There needs to be some responsible management. And I think if you read the report from this koala committee, the overwhelming loss of habitat, koala habitat and koalas has been from devastation of bushfires, whether it's the Wormalong fires in the Pilliga or these latest fires this last season now. That is not the fault of farmers.
The state's agriculture minister, Adam Marshall, has also cast scepticism on his government's data, saying anyone with brains know they only tell one side of the story and can't be read in isolation. In a statement to PM, the minister says the vast majority of native vegetation cleared in New South Wales are invasive native species, such as weeds, which harm biodiversity. He added it's illogical to use data tied to a redundant piece of legislation to judge the success of a new policy framework. Conservation planner Christine Hosking isn't of the same view.
You know, the scales are tipped way too far in a human-centred direction at the moment, which is understandable. But I guess until there's a dollar value placed on biodiversity and on the environment, it's not going to happen.
Christine Hosking is a conservation planner with the University of Queensland. Gavin Coote with that report. Well, a global campaign is putting the social media behemoth Facebook under immense pressure over its facilitation of hate speech. More than 500 companies in the US kicked off an advertising boycott today, intended to pressure Facebook into taking a stronger stand against vile posts that leverage racism and misogyny and the like. This boycott alone won't hurt the company financially, analysts say, but there are already signs that Facebook is worrying about a public relations disaster. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Coca-Cola. It's one of the most recognised brands in the world.
Taste the feeling.
It's among hundreds of big-name companies pulling advertising on Facebook in July.
I'd imagine as a business, clearly they would be concerned.
That's Dominic Pearman, Managing Director of Pearman Media and a member of business group Independent Media Agencies. He knows Facebook is worrying about the Stop Hate for Profits movement because the firm asked one of its Asia-Pacific representatives to call him and suss out how much traction the movement was gaining down under. He told them he hadn't heard of anything. But this morning that changed when he received an email from a client.
Who wants us to pause advertising for one day on July the 7th on Facebook.
Does that worry you at all? I mean, this is how you make your bread and butter.
No, not really, because it's one day. The advertising dollars will be spent elsewhere.
The Stop Hate for Profit campaign began last month following the death of George Floyd. It aims to bring businesses together and harness their power. It's now turned on Facebook. They say Facebook's platform helps drive hate speech. The idea is to drain Facebook of billions in advertising revenue, effectively holding it hostage. Sydney University digital expert Mark Pesci says that won't work, but that doesn't mean it won't hurt Facebook.
All right, so only 20% of Facebook's advertising revenue comes from the big advertisers. These are the advertisers who would be on TV or in most magazines. Facebook has what we call a long tail, which is lots of small and medium enterprises that are advertising directly to buyers, to consumers on Facebook. Those folks are not going to stop advertising. So even if every one of the big advertisers pulled out of Facebook, yes, they'd take a revenue hit. It would not be a fatal hit to them.
Well, Mark Pesci, then the obvious question, what's the point?
Well, I think the point is to at least elevate the issue because it helps just the fact of a boycott and a boycott with many major folks helps other people to be aware of how Facebook is failing to deal with hate speech. And then you have been seeing them taking more steps in the last month around policing hate speech than they have, say, in the past 5 years.
The groups outlined 10 demands for Facebook, including allowing people who experience severe harassment to speak with a Facebook employee. Now, Mark Zuckerberg has already made attempts to clean up Facebook's platform. He claims, for example, his staff takes down 89% of hate speech before anyone sees it. But the chair of Digital Rights Watch, Lizzie O'Shea, says the very laws Mark Zuckerberg claims he's complying with are out of date.
There's lots of questions around what kind of speech we're prepared to allow on a platform like this that perhaps aren't adequately answered by the law and need updating through public debate about what we think is appropriate and what isn't for a platform that many people treat as a public space when in fact it's a private company who's regulating it. And I think this is the bigger question. How do we come to terms with these problems? How do we solve them? The law might provide some answers, but I think they're bigger philosophical ones that we probably need to contend with.
Has Facebook done enough, in your view, to limit hate speech on its platform?
Oh, I think Facebook clearly has a problem with hate speech and it could do more. I think it could bring the public into these debates better to talk about how it might be able to do that. And I think we probably as a society need to think about how we want to regulate them better. I mean, it's a huge responsibility that this company has. Many people use the platform. Maybe the company's not the best person to be deciding it and maybe we shouldn't always be looking for them to do so, but in fact have more transparency and accountability around how they make these kinds of rules.
Mark Pesci says if the advertising boycott can help drive changes to the law, then Facebook Facebook will be forced to clear all hate speech from its platform.
One of the things that's become very clear is that Facebook's business model is to keep people engaged by keeping them enraged. And there were some publications in the Wall Street Journal about 6 weeks ago which really laid out the fact that Facebook knew this very well. So in fact, the policing of hate speech is something that actually impacts Facebook's business model more than a boycott.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg has agreed to meet with the organisers of Stop Hate for Profit early next week.
David Taylor with that report. And that's PM. I'm Linda Mottram. You can find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. Do subscribe and do leave us a review. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Scott Morrison wants to spend $270 billion on defence over the next decade, and the shopping list includes long-range missiles, satellites and undersea sensors. The subtext is that we need to protect ourselves from China. So how much danger are we in?
Today on The Signal, we're glimpsing the government's vision of the hostile new world that is likely to surround us in coming years, as well as its blueprint for a more aggressive Australia to meet it. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.